And this week on Africa Update, we have more on the political crisis in Kenya. President Bush also has pledged aid to Africa, but is it enough? And France extends an olive branch to Rwanda. For more on all of this, we've got Bill Fletcher. He is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of Trans-Africa Forum. Hi, Bill.
Hey.
So we just heard Afebia Quist Arkton's report, very vivid report on the violence in Kenya's Rift Valley area. Can you tell us a bit more about that area? Give us some background on the ethnic groups that live there.
Well, as was mentioned on the report, the Kikuyu were moved into the area in the 1960s as part of a settlement policy. And so there's been tensions between the Kikuyu and other tribes that are, quote-unquote, indigenous to the area for quite some time. But I think that what your listeners have to appreciate is that this situation has been simmering for a while. This is, however, not primarily an ethnic conflict. It's a politicization through ethnicity of a conflict. In other words, the basic issue is that there's been longstanding discrimination, there's been a longstanding lack of real democracy in Kenya that's played itself out along ethnic lines. And with the apparent stealing of the election, the country has just begun to unravel, and it's become increasingly serious. I mean, the last time I was on the program, I said that I believe that the Odinga and Kibaki can come to a settlement, but I'm not clear what the long-lasting impact will be for Kenya itself. And I feel that the same way today.
Now, when you mention the Kikuyu, they're the largest group. Are they the ones who've been politically favored in this whole equation over the past decades?
Yes, they have been largely favored. But when Kibaki first came to power, part of why he represented such a broad front was the notion of a true democratization of Kenya, meaning not simply the end of a literal dictatorship, which the country had been suffering, but also the end of favoritism for any particular ethnic group. And the difficulty is that when he took power, he reneged on those promises, which set the stage for the current conflict.
How has Kenya been, what was Kenya's path out of colonialism? I mean, Africa over the past century has been unfolding and unpacking its colonial history. Does any of this have to do with how Kenya emerged from colonialism?
Yes and no. The Kenyans, as people will remember, fought a war against Britain, and it was Britain was the colonizer, and it was known as the Mau Mau Uprising in the West. The British had originally conceived of turning Kenya into a settler state along the lines of then Rhodesia or South Africa, but moved away from that. Jomo Kenyatta, the first president of Kenya, was associated with the Mau Mau and was expected by many people to not only be a champion of African liberation, but a champion of a transformation of Africa. However, shortly after taking power, he became a very close ally of the British in the United States and did not undertake any significant steps to transform the long-standing problems of Kenya, land control, issues of distribution of wealth, etc. And so these problems that we're seeing now, you can see their root in the failure to actually embark on a transformational effort in the 1960s.
One of the things that we do on News and Notes is we answer letters, and we recently got a letter about the use of the word tribe. We intend to do a bigger exploration of it, but the whole question from one of our listeners was, is the word tribe or tribal applicable in this case, and why or why not, in terms of talking about the violence and the political factions?
That's a great question, Farai. I usually use the term ethnic group largely because tribe as a term has been used in European and North American parlance to refer to ethnic groups in places where the people are of color. I mean, that's the reality. Mm. So whether it's Africa or Native Americans in North America, South America, or in fact in Asia. So I think that the term tribe often carries with it a condescending note. We're basically talking about an ethnic conflict, which in many ways is not altogether different than the conflicts that erupted in the former Yugoslavia and tore that country apart.
There are many different nations throughout the continent of Africa that are hubs for commerce, for community building. Kenya has been one of those places. How is it affecting the region that this is going on in Kenya?
Well, Kenya has been blessed with a moderate climate and has been a center for tourism in addition to trade, as you mentioned. And the current situation is absolutely destabilizing the country economically. So it is affecting internal commerce. There's been a great deal of discussion about the impact on the Kenyan so-called middle class, the professional managerial groupings that are becoming very fearful of their futures. But it also discourages any kind of long-term investment into the country itself.
Now, Kenya and the U.S. have had a long-standing relationship, and there are, for example, more Kenyan students studying in the U.S. than students from any other African nation. So what's the tie there? What's the relationship, and why is there such a strong relationship between Kenya and the U.S.?
Well, I think that it goes back to an earlier point, that after independence, Kenya, under the leadership of Jomo Kenyatta, was prepared to submit itself to a neo-colonial status under Britain and the United States. And to put it in less inflammatory terms, they became a very close ally of the United States in the Cold War. And they basically followed economic policies that Britain and the United States subscribed to. So there is this long-standing relationship. There was no real attempt by the Kenyan government to take a different path, as we discussed earlier. What's interesting about the current crisis is, as you may remember, right after the election results were announced, the United States was prepared to recognize Kibaki as having been reelected. It was only after growing international protests of the apparent illegality of the election that the United States backed off. But they were prepared to settle for a continuation of Kibaki's rule.
Now, I want to turn to another topic. As we heard earlier in the show, last night the president gave his last State of the Union address. He pledged billions of dollars to combat HIV and AIDS in Africa. Let's take a listen.
America is leading the fight against disease. With your help, we're working to cut by half the number of malaria-related deaths in 15 African nations. And our emergency plan for AIDS relief is treating 1.4 million people. We can bring healing and hope to many more. So I ask you to maintain the principles that have changed behavior and made this program a success. And I call on you to double our initial commitment to fighting HIV/AIDS by approving an additional $30 billion over the next 5 years.
So, Bill, what do you make of the president's remarks?
Every time I hear President Bush talk about billions, I start thinking about Carl Sagan and talking about billions of stars and billions of this. Part of the problem when I listen to and consider what President Bush is talking about is more what he doesn't talk about, that U.S. aid to Africa is significant in terms of dollar amounts that are mentioned, but as a percentage of what the United States does offers internationally, it's actually not all that significant. A couple of years ago, I did a little research on this and discovered that U.S. aid to Africa, if you withdraw Egypt, is less than the aid to Israel. The total aid is less than the aid to one country, a key ally of the United States. So that figure told me a little bit about the priorities of the United States. The second thing is that there are regularly strings attached to U.S. aid. So whether it's the assistance to combat HIV and AIDS, there are these strings around the issue of abstinence only, as a condition for significant amounts of aid to combat that disease. A second issue is that whereas the United Nations has had a internationally recognized program combating AIDS, HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, the Bush administration has refused to give full funding to that UN program and instead was more interested in setting up its own bureaucracy to offer assistance, which seems to run contrary to all of the rhetoric about, that the conservatives often offer about limiting costs. So I think that what the listener has to concern themselves with is not simply the billions and billions that are mentioned, but the character of the money. What percentage does it really represent of U.S. foreign aid? Is it going in the way that it needs to go? For example, when you have the Millennium Challenge account, which was the way that Bush redesigned foreign aid, part of what he did with that was condition the countries receiving aid based on their accepting conditions to redefine their economies to meet the design of the United States.
Well, Bill, one last question very quickly.
Certainly.
The president is about to head off on another swing to the continent. Is this about legacy building? What kind of legacy will he leave behind?
When he went to Africa in the early part of his first administration, I called it a magical mystery tour. This I'd call a retirement cruise. I see no serious attention to the real problems that Africa has, no real attention to the issue of the United States playing a role in repairing the damage that the United States and Europe has done to Africa. And I just think that, yes, this is legacy in a most cynical of manners.
What do you hope, again briefly, that the next administration, Republican or Democrat, could bring to the table?
A discussion about repairing the damage on the continent. Absolutely. Of partnering with the African Union. Of moving away from unilateralism and moving into partnership with African countries to discuss their needs and how and what kind of assistance they need for self-determined development. That's what I would hope and pray for.
Well, Bill, thanks so much.
Anytime. Thank you.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of Trans-Africa Forum. He spoke with us from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters.